Thanks for listening to the Suzy Larson Life podcast, available thanks to support from listeners like you. It's only just a matter of welcome to Suzy Larson Live. Always so honored to get to spend this time with you. In fact, I look forward to bringing you conversations every single day that hopefully inspire you in your faith walk, that deepen your understanding of God's Word, and that heightens your awareness of His very real presence in your life. Well, my guest today is country music singer Granger Smith. And on a sunny day in 2019, Granger found his three-year-old son face down in their pool, unconscious. And the days that followed were filled with grief, sorrow, questions, but eventually an encounter with God that changed everything. We're drawing from his newly released New York Times best-selling book, Like a River, Finding the Faith and Strength to Move Forward After Loss and Heartache. This is a raw, honest, hopeful book. It's amazing. We've got a handful of copies to give away today. I couldn't put it down. It was so well done. You can text the word book if you want in on the drawing, 877-933-2484. A quick announcement before we hear from Granger, and it's this. Thank you. With all our hearts, thank you. When we normally do our end-of-year fundraiser, we do it, as you know, over the course of 3.5 days. But Carissa, our general manager, said, we're doing it in one day. And boy, you didn't disappoint. God didn't disappoint. We're blown away by what you did, and we're so grateful to God. And I'm just praying that God would replenish your storehouses many times over for your faithfulness. And we're so grateful to serve God in this way and to do this journey together. So just want to say a big hearty thank you. All right, let me tell you about my guest. We'll get him on the show. Granger Smith is the New York Times bestselling author of the book we're talking about today, Like a River, Finding Faith and Strength to Move Forward After Loss and Heartache, where he shares the tragic loss of his son, River. After 24 years touring as an award-winning, platinum-selling country music singer, songwriter, Granger chose to leave the music business to pursue a future in ministry. He's currently attending seminary. He and his wife, Amber, live in north of Austin, Texas, with their kids, London, Lincoln, and Maverick. And Granger, I told him before the show, he and I share the same acquisitions editor, Kyle Olin, from Thomas Nelson, who speaks so highly of him. So I'm so grateful to finally get to meet you, Granger. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. That's a very gracious introduction. So I'm honored to be on the show. Thank you.
Yep, looking forward to our conversation. And Granger, every single day I ask the same question before we get into the content of whatever book we're talking about. And it's a more personal, your whole book is personal, but this question is really just has to do with how you walk with God. What's He been impressing upon your heart these days?
I am definitely in a season of equipping with God, for sure. As much as I am speaking and doing interviews and podcasting or just talking to people, sharing the gospel, simple evangelism, as much as I'm doing that these days, I need to be poured into doubly. I need to be taking in way more than I'm pouring out. Otherwise, that's just simple mathematics. I'll go empty. So because of this season of equipping, it's been overwhelming at times, but always restful and hopeful and peaceful at the same time. And that's interesting for me to say that, because in my life, I've never really equated all those things together. Usually it's during a season of busyness, I'm also the least rested and least peaceful and least hopeful. I'm a grouch, usually in those times. But in this season of my life, the busyness of studying God's word or writing a seminary paper or prepping for a message that I'll be giving on a Sunday, during those times, it seems that the more I study and just kind of go through that quote unquote busyness, I feel the restfulness as well in learning who God is. And that's something new to me and very exciting.
I love that so much. Well, if you don't mind, I'd love a little backstory on your family's journey before that fateful day in 2019, like how you got your break in music and how you navigated family life. Just what was life like for you before then?
Sure. I met my wife, probably the most cliche way that a country singer could meet a wife, And that was in my, she was the girl in my very first music video. She was the love interest. And
wow.
We actually fell in love. We fell in love shooting that very first music video. And we started dating shortly after, and we were engaged probably 7 months after that video shoot, and then married right at 1 year after that video shoot. So lived a wonderful fairy tale ish type life before we lost Riv. My career was, no one knew who I was, and I didn't have any kind of traction in the music business when we got married. But slowly but surely, we diligently worked and worked and worked at that, and got a significant enough following in the country music world that I was very happy, and I was living a dream, and I was in love, and we had three beautiful kids, and we lived in a place that we had only dreamed about. And that's where we were on the evening of June 4th, 2019.
Mm. And on that night, I remember you, I was a gymnast growing up as well, so that grabbed my attention. You're spotting your daughter in handstands, and she's showing you her gymnastics routine. And as you did with a three-year-old, everybody's asking, where's Riv? Where's Riv? Because, you know, you've got a house full of kids. It's just, that is how that goes. So if you don't mind, as much as you feel comfortable, bring us to that day.
Yeah, and I think you're the first one to really acknowledge that the gymnastics routine. London, my daughter, she was seven at the time. She's 12 now. And she invited me out that evening. It was about 7:30 at night. And she invited me out, just a beautiful evening, to go out to the grass in the backyard and spot her on a new routine that she'd been working on. She was really into gymnastics. And so it was this, you know, as elaborate as it could get for a seven-year-old girl. We go outside and barefoot in the backyard, and the boys followed us out, and they picked up some water guns. They were in their PJs getting ready for bed. But they went out for one more, you know, little romp around the backyard with their water guns. And I remember, as I was spotting my daughter, she was doing a handstand and I was holding her ankles. I remember thinking, what a beautiful night. You know, soak in this moment, because these kind of nights won't last forever. This moment won't last forever. Thinking the kids are going to get older. They are 7, 5, and 3. This moment will be gone. They'll be out of the house. They'll be out of college. And directly following that thought was the next thought was, it's quiet. The boys are quiet. And that's not a good thing when you have a three-year-old, because it's usually always loud. I didn't think about our swimming pool because it was gated, at a child gate, fence, and it was always locked. And so I didn't think about that. It was never really a concern growing up in that. But when we moved into that house, actually, we built the fence. That's the first thing we did years and years before that, before River was even born. But I turned around on that one particular evening and looked back, and inside of that gate, River had made his way in there, and he was in the middle of the pool face down. That was an image that I couldn't compute, couldn't understand. There was too many questions for any of it to make sense in my mind. How did he get in there? What's he doing there? Is he unconscious? How long has he been in there? I just saw him a couple minutes ago running through the yard playing water gun fight. So irregardless of all that, those thoughts, I'd crashed into the water and pulled him out, expecting him to be coughing and gasping for air and scared and probably crying. But that's not what happened. Instead, he was lifeless and cold, and his skin was blue, and his eyes were opened, and it was terrifying. As I pulled him out of the water, began CPR the best that I could, maybe from watching TV and movies in the past. I tried to perform a futile CPR as my wife came out and brought my phone. We called 911 and emergency services. It took them about 10 minutes to arrive because of where we lived. We lived out in the country. And although they were able to recover his heartbeat when they got back with electric shock, 10 minutes was too long for his little brain to be unconscious without oxygen. And Within about 24 hours after that, he was pronounced dead in the hospital.
I just don't even have words. I don't even have words. I don't even know what to say. There's so many questions I have. You know, your son's name, River, what a great name, River. And you use river as a metaphor in this book for life and how it always flows downstream and that rivers actually help us survive. Say more about that.
Yeah, those are all thoughts in hindsight. Looking back and reflecting and writing the book after half a decade had gone by of that, and a lot of life in between, a lot of reflection on the suffering itself and on working our way through suffering, moving forward through suffering, and thinking of life as a river that many times our lives get dammed up, blocked. There's obstacles. Sometimes they're wide. Sometimes they're peaceful. Sometimes the waters are deep and sometimes they're shallow with rapids and rocks. But the water is always moving downstream. Now, if our life is always moving downstream, sometimes we have a tendency to dam it up or to build nice little banks with brick. We have a tendency to ride the river in our little self-made boats or with our little paddles and oars. And for the most part, we can navigate our own river pretty well. And we can come across some rapids and we could stabilize ourselves with our little oars that we've built. But sooner or later, I would say that everyone in life, everyone listening right now, sooner or later will reach a point in their lives if they haven't already, when their self-made oars and their own paddle boats cannot withhold the waterfall that the river inevitably comes to. And that is the waterfall that I ended up meeting in that year of 2019.
Mm. Wow. I found it really interesting and even insightful for, I don't know if it was the doctors or nurses or the chaplain, somebody at the hospital who really encouraged you not to go home and tell your kids that river's in a better place. He's sleeping peacefully because it could possibly make them want to go be with him. They wanted you to say it straight. Say a word about that and how that, again, as much as you're comfortable, how that went for you.
Yeah, through the many conversations we had at the hospital, one of them came through the just the humanitarian services there at the Children's Hospital that were used to dealing with situations like this. And they needed us to go home, or I would say they highly recommended us to go home and communicate with our children that your little brother has died. He has he didn't have enough oxygen. His brain was too sick and he didn't make it. Mm-hmm. Putting a finality to this, to his life on earth, so that as to not confuse a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old, that he might be, maybe he's an angel, maybe he's a butterfly sitting on your shoulder, maybe he's just sleeping peacefully. There's a lot of weird comments that could start messing with a child's mind. Yeah. And in hindsight, I agree that it was a good decision to be as straightforward as we could with our kids.
Wow. So insightful. How did you, we've got a few minutes before this first break, but how did you help your kids? How did they work out their grief and their little minds? I mean, to be so young. And thinking of London, you know, who was doing her gymnastics routine and at that young age had the wisdom to run to the front to be of help. She just jumped to action and she's waving down the emergency, you know, vehicle. And I mean, that blew my mind that she just sort of instinctively knew to do that. How did you help them and how did they express their grief?
You know, there were two situations at play with which each child. London, her burden, her cross to bear was that she was there with me with the gymnastics. Mm. And so when I looked over and saw Riv in the water, she was with me. She saw him with me and she ran with me. And then Lincoln's cross to bear is the fact that he was playing a water gun fight with River. And then for whatever reason, we still don't know, ended up quitting the game and going back into the house. And so with each of those, with the possible guilt for Lincoln and the trauma, the visual PTSD trauma that London saw, both of those required professional help. And so they both went into play therapy immediately. They went into play therapy, and they both actually did very, very well in the play therapy. So much so that they graduated with their out of that their individual classes, and probably 6 weeks or so they were released, and the psychiatrist said, "Hey, that they're both doing great. We don't see any signs of trauma that will continue. That's abnormal. That's not normal for someone who's lost their sibling." And outside of that, Amber and I were very open with them that, hey, whatever you're feeling, it's okay. If you want to laugh, that's okay. If you want to cry, that's okay. If you want to look at pictures of River and remember and giggle and think it's funny, that's okay. If you don't want to look at pictures because it's too hard, that's okay too. There is not a right or wrong way. And we also live that out ourselves with our own emotions. We didn't hide anything. And yet we still moved forward in our lives as, hey, we're still going to celebrate. We're still going to cook a Thanksgiving turkey, for instance, at the end of that year. We're still going to move forward. You're still going to get a Christmas present. We tried to continue moving forward with River in our minds and in our hearts. And I think that did well for the children.
Amazing. I mean, to me, that shows so much of the infrastructure you and Amber had before this happened. I mean, as you said in the book so well, and we've covered this topic with other people, other experts, you know, brain scientists and others, saying there's nothing that can prepare you for this truly. There's just anything we prop ourselves up with is insufficient. However, there was something built in your infrastructure that allowed you for that to kick in, for you to help your kids navigate that and to give yourselves permission to grieve however you needed to grieve. We're going to break here. When we come back, I want you to take me to that place in the story where you, your pastor came to visit and walked your property. And this, the way you describe this property, it's just acreage, you know, an old southern kind of farmhouse with a porch and just a beautiful place to raise a family. And he walked the grounds with you and said something to you. We're going to take that on the other side. Talking to Granger Smith, New York Times bestselling author, country music singer. His book is titled Like a River, Finding the Faith and Strength to Move Forward After Loss and Heartache. Got a handful of copies to give away. You're not going to be able to put it down. I'm just telling you that right now. You can text the word book to 877-933-2484. We'll be back in a minute. This is Susie Larson, host of Susie Larson Live. Christmas is my favorite time of year. I remember back in our young years when we were struggling to make ends meet, and someone surprised us with bags of groceries and gifts under the tree. All these years later now, we love to surprise others who have a need. Maybe you know someone who has a need this Christmas. You can give hope to someone this Christmas this year by sharing their story at myfaithradio.com. Help us help them and be a blessing to someone this year on myfaithradio.com. I pray you're having a really good day. Thanks for tuning in to Susie Larson Live, talking to New York Times bestselling author Granger Smith, who released a book that's tough to put down. It's called Like a River, Finding the Faith and Strength to Move Forward After Loss and Heartache. It's raw, real, honest, and hopeful at the same time. Granger was a country music singer, toured with a lot of the top artists, and had a beautiful family, wife, and three children. And one night in 2019, he was out spotting his daughter in some gymnastics when his three-year-old, he looked over his shoulder and found his three-year-old was in their pool face down, a pool that was gated and locked. They don't even know how he got in there, but and we're picking the story up from just the journey through loss and heartbreak. When you find hope again, how do you navigate such times? And there's a point in the story, Granger, where your pastor walked your property with you in preparation for the funeral, and he looked around and with tears in his eyes told you that you can't stay here. You'd probably have to move. Was he giving words to something you'd already thought, or did that just occur to you when he said it?
No, he was just kind of reassuring a thought that certainly I had. There was no way I could live in a house and sit on the back porch and sip some iced tea in a rocking chair overlooking that pool, that evil blue water, the killer, the murderer of my son. There's no way I could have stayed there. And so, yeah, as I walked the backyard with him, and he came over just to kind of, he was building his message for the funeral service, and he wanted to kind of just get an idea of Rivers' little area that he played in, look at some of his toys, and go out into the backyard that River loved to be in barefooted so many times. And it was that time that he was walking back, and he said, oh, Granger, you're going to have to move, as he looked at the pool. It's interesting to continue on that story, even past the book now. He ended up retiring after that funeral service. Was the last thing he did. He was getting older, and he just thought this is pastoral ministry was something he was going to have to pass on to the younger generation. What's very interesting is, as we do this interview, is that from the time you and I are recording this, just 5 days ago, I went and actually preached at his church.
Wow.
Last Sunday morning. And so what an interesting full circle moment.
Right.
Of this older pastor now walking this guy who just lost his son. Fast forward 5 years, he's preaching at his church. That's only God can do something like that.
Yep. He's such a redeemer. And a couple of points that you made in your book that I'm sure are becoming more true to you with each passing day. Hard to see when you're in the middle of the pain, but pain is not permanent and pain is not pointless. At what point, I have so many questions for you, I'm trying to restrain myself. This is okay. Live radio after all. At what point in your story did that truth start to spring up in your soul? Pain is not permanent and it's not pointless.
Believe it or not, at the very beginning, at ground zero of the tragedy, that began to become apparent to Amber and I both. And it happened in this way. As we were contemplating when to turn off the breathing machine, the doctor said he's gone, he's not going to make it. At this point, you just need to go and decide when you want us to turn off the machine. That's the only thing to decide at this point. And so Amber and I took this little walk through the Serenity Garden of the hospital. And we talked about our marriage, and we talked about a commitment that we would make to each other. And we talked about how the enemy would attack us, and that most people get divorced in a moment like this, and most families fall apart, and the hardship that it was going to be, that the incredibly difficult road that we had no idea the depth of the hardship that we would be facing. But as we walked back in to tell them the appropriate time to turn off the machine, Amber said something that threw us all for a loop. It caught me off guard and everyone else in the room off guard. And she said to the doctor, she said, "I want to donate his organs." And I looked at her, and the doctors looked at her, and they said, "Okay, well, that's going to require, we're going to need some more time. It's going to require a new team of surgeons that will have to come in. We're going to now find an appropriate recipient for these different organs from River." And she said, his little body is perfect. His brain is dead, but his little body is perfect. I want to be able to help someone else. So it was there in that hospital room on day one of losing him that we realized, although we weren't feeling good again, although things weren't right, things were horribly wrong, there was a shred of hope. There was a shred of purpose, because now it wasn't all bad. It was 99.9% bad for us at that time, but there was 0.1% said, "Hang on a second, these organs are going to go out to help another family." So you can't say it's all bad. You can't say it's all meaningless, because what do you say to that family that now it's getting this organ that they've been waiting on this donor list? All of a sudden they get a call. "Hey, miracle happened. There's an organ now that matches your child. Your child is going to live now." So to them, it's a miracle. It's the greatest day, and it's a new hope for them. So all of a sudden, there is purpose in the pain. It's not meaningless. There was many more examples that happened after that, but that was the first one.
Wow, for God to do that. And in the book, this line of what Amber said, "Surely there are people in the world who could use this tragedy as their miracle." I almost choked up when I read that. I mean, and if again, that to me speaks to what was in her before this happened, right? I mean, when you get bumped up against, you kind of see what spills out is what's in you. And for that to come out of her, is pretty amazing to me. And what I loved, I laughed out loud. I mean, I wanted to cry at the same time. But when you asked when it was time for him to be wheeled down for that surgery, they found the matches for these organs. And this was it. This was really going to be your goodbye. And you asked the doctors and nurses to race him down the hall fast. Say a word about that.
Yeah. River loved to go fast. As a three-year-old, he liked whether he was on a go-kart with his brother or on a little toy tractor that he had that he wanted a bigger battery in so he can go faster. He always loved to go faster, faster, Daddy. That's what he would say. And as they were wheeling him to get his to take him into the organ donation surgery, that was the last goodbye. That's when we would say goodbye to him from one room, and he would go to the other side of the hospital, and we would walk him down there, and he would go through those big gray double doors and be gone. Well, as we were walking him down, the nurses, you know, had a hand on the hospital bed. It just occurred to me in that moment, here he goes. This is his last ride. And I told the doctor, I said, "Hey, man, this kid, River, he loved to go fast. Do you think maybe we could push him a little faster?" And he looked at me quickly, and I could just see his face light up, and he said, "Hey, everyone, this boy liked to go fast. We're going to push him fast." And everyone kind of started smiling, and they kind of picked up to a little bit of a jog going down this hospital hallway. Wow. And all the doors that leading down to the surgery room, they all started opening, and these other patients and families started coming out and kind of started putting their hands together, and they felt the energy. They felt what was happening was special, and they started clapping. And I thought, there he is. He's going fast one more time.
Wow. What a story. I wonder if they're going to make a movie out of this book. I do. I wonder if they are. You know, when we come back from the break, Granger, I want to talk about, again, as much as you are comfortable, I'm just going off of what I've read in the book, but I know how it's not probably always easy to share the story, but the grief process. And you talked about the slideshow, the images that were played in your mind. I want to go to that part of your story, what happened and how you dealt with it, how God navigated, helped you navigate, and even where he was in all of that. Did he seem silent? Did he seem absent? Did he seem present? Like I told you, I got lots of questions. Talking to Granger Smith today, his book is Like a River, Finding the Faith and Strength to Move Forward After Loss and Heartbreak. What a story. You can text the word book if you want in on the drawing, 877-933-2484. We'll be back in a minute. Thanks so much for tuning into Susie Larson Live, talking to country singer Granger Smith. He's also a seminary student. In fact, he's left the music industry to enter full-time ministry. He's written a New York Times best-selling book, Like a River, Finding the Faith and Strength to Move Forward After Loss and Heartache. And it was one sunny night, 2019, he was out in the backyard with his daughter, helping her with her gymnastics routine, when he looked over his shoulder and saw that his three-year-old son was face down in the pool, unconscious. And we're talking about just that story. And it's such a powerful story. I'm so grateful to Thomas Nelson for the handful of copies we get to give away today. You'll have a hard time putting this book down. And it's not just a tragic story. There's so much hope, so much insight and wisdom in this book. It's really, especially if someone you know is walking through a valley of their own, I highly recommend it. You can text the word book to 877-933-2484. So the days after, Granger, you talked about the slideshow, and you talked about how these images just would replay in your mind. Talk to us about that, and what'd you do about it?
Yeah, Susie, I think probably the foundation I need to build before we talk about slideshow and my recovery from the PTSD of losing River is this. I thought I was a Christian. I grew up in a Christian home, very faithful parents, grew up in church and Sunday school and small groups and fellowship of Christian athletes and youth groups. If there was a Christian activity, I did it. If there was something to know about Christianity, I knew it intellectually. I could tell you I could articulate the gospel and what it meant for Jesus to go to the cross and what it meant for him to take on sin as the substitute, as the sacrificial lamb. I probably could have told you that pretty well. I probably could have articulated it enough. I could have defended it enough. I could have told you scripture that I had memorized, things like Romans 5:8 and of course John 3:16. I need to say that because I need to qualify what happened during the slideshow and what happened as my raft, as we mentioned earlier, went off the edge of the waterfall. Suddenly, I realized I was depending on myself for so long. Although I knew the gospel, although I grew up in church, I had drifted far from it. I had no fruits in my life that showed significant change, significant new creation, new birth, a new heart, a living for Christ, sanctified for Christ by the gospel, through the gospel. I had no evidence of a forward progress, of desire to know God more, to read his word, to be covenanting with his people on a Sunday morning, to be gathering with God's people. I had none of that. I was a touring musician. I was already Christian. I was already saved. And that was something I did when I was a kid. I was good to go. Now I was all about self-improvement and learning to better myself and meditating and visualizing a dream and a goal and making things happen. I was good at watching what I ate and watching how I exercised and being the control. I was in control of my boat. I was the captain of my ship. So it's really important to say that I realized, and I call it in the book, dog tag Christianity, meaning in World War II, when soldiers went off to war, they would get a dog tag and they would ask them what religion they were so that they would know what kind of priest to use at the funeral if they died. So it's like, boom, Christianity. That's what I was. It was nothing more than a heritage. I see that in hindsight. I would have argued that fiercely 10 years ago, but now I see it in hindsight and go, oh man, that was so dangerous to be living in a world where I didn't desire to go to church. I didn't desire to read God's word, not because it earned any kind of credibility with God, not because it earned a salvation or punched the ticket to heaven, but that is a result of a saving faith. That out of gratitude, you want to be around God's people. You want to learn God's word. I didn't have that. So God made that evident when I lost my son, that I could no longer rely on myself like I thought I could. And when that little boat went off the waterfall, I saw a constant reminder, which I called the slideshow, of these images of the bad moments, rivers in the pool, the hospital, the funeral, the doctor saying he's not going to make it, us telling the kids that they lost it, their little brother. These images would replay constantly, and it haunted me, and it destroyed me, and it slowly, like acid, ate away my mind until I had nothing left.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you. Thank you for giving us that context. You know, I say often, how many Christians are walking the planet right now who know they're saved but don't know they're loved? And I think if it's duty or obligation, you're not going to be drawn to God. But when you know that you're profoundly, deeply, truly loved, it does make such a difference. And I love, love, love. As terrible as this is that you walk through, I love that it chased you to God and not away from him, because many, many would have run away. And thank you, Lord, that you're in deeper with him. I just think that's absolutely amazing. You know, I got so mad when I was reading about the social media comments. I just can't even stand it. That, you know, to talk about adding, you know, to your burden and to your wounding, that people accused you guys, blamed you guys, questioned your parenting. Talk about just how that added so much salt to the wound. And I want to say this because every once in a while I'll cover this on the show, that it's so easy to be behind your phone and just lash out and say heartless things as, you know, professing Christians and not even thinking about the consequence of how that lands on real people on the other side. So tell us some of what you endured and how that added to the pain for you.
Certainly. And probably people listening now have at least, if they're honest with themselves, at least thought at some point in this conversation, why was Granger not watching his three-year-old son? You know, it would only be natural. And of course, I don't blame you, listener, for thinking that, but it would only be natural because I do the same thing. We all do that. We look outside of a situation, it's someone else's story, and we go, oh, that was preventable. You know, there must be more that we don't know about. And I saw that play itself out on social media, on comments. Every time a new media outlet would cover the story and it would get outside of my own friend group or the people that actually knew who I was, the people would say, lock that guy up in prison. That guy deserves the death penalty for someone to not be able to be responsible enough to take care of his own son. And he should get the death penalty himself. And I would see that stuff. But the problem, Susie, this is what's crazy. The problem was not that I saw that. The problem was I agreed more with them, the critics, than I did with the people that said, Granger, you don't have anything to blame for yourself. You need to forgive yourself. This is not your fault. You are a good dad. I disagreed with that at the core of my being. And I agreed with the person that said, this guy's an idiot for not watching his child. That was the problem.
Oh, you know, when you think about it, if anybody's had kids, especially young kids close together, you can't have certainty and you can't have perfection. You can't. It's just at any given moment, things could happen. It's a miracle that they don't happen more often, right? I mean, that is just the way it is. But when in the day of social media where people can spew this crap, I'm sorry, but it just makes me so mad, to a grieving father, it's so evil to me. But again, it's so interesting how God redeems everything, because they were mirroring back to you what you were doing to yourself. And God, I think, maybe wanted you to see it in Technicolor, going, this will kill you. If you allow that to linger in your soul, that you'll die twice, right? And so how did you get to a point then where you had to say, I'm rejecting that from out within and I'm rejecting it from without?
I'm so glad you asked. The route to bring me there is complicated and a windy road. But it did just about kill me. I ended up in a place where I absolutely wanted to take my own life, thought that would probably be a much better scenario than to stay on this earth as a failed father. But I want to get right to the point, because I think the point is more important than the journey of getting to that point. And the point is this: I felt guilty. I felt like a failure. And regardless of if I told myself, I'm not a failure, I'm a good dad, I am not guilty, I am guiltless when it comes to fatherhood or being a man, the more I told myself that, the less I believed it, because at the core of my being, I knew I was the responsible adult in the backyard that evening of June 4th, 2019. But this is the thing that the world doesn't tell you, and this is the one thing that heals: the gospel. When Jesus came to live the perfect life, to fulfill the law in a way that none of us could, so that shame and guilt and sin and mistakes in a fallen world were covered. So that Jesus says, I went to the cross and I took on the wrath of God, the punishment that we deserve. I took it on myself in my body and was resurrected 3 days later, so that you could be covered, so that you could become guiltless. Not because of your own doing and not because you are guiltless, but because I'm guiltless and I'm covering you with my guiltlessness, my sinlessness, my perfection. I have covered you, cleaned you. I have called you by name. You are mine. And that was the answer I needed. That's when I go, you mean it's okay if I think I am guilty because he looks at me as not guilty? Great. Because my identity is not in myself. My identity is not what I think of myself. It's how he thinks of me. It's what he calls me to be. It's what he understands me to be. Why? Because he created me. So I want him. I want his opinion. I want his identity. That's right. And he says, you're clean. You are not guilty. You are perfect in my eyes. Not because of yourself, but because of what I've done on the cross.
Amen.
That message is the gospel, and it saved me.
Yeah. And it's the only message that can save you. I mean, you know, one of my guests said a while back, the gospel is so much more than we know. He said, there's nothing more than the gospel, and the gospel is so much more than we know. When we come back, I have a few questions I hope we can have time to cover. But one, you had to go back to work. How did you do that? What that was like for you? And also, we do cover brain science on this show. We cover healing a lot on the show, just the healing process, inner healing, things like that. And I'd not ever heard the term brain spotting before, but I thought it was super interesting how your therapist helped you, you know, track some places in your mind and your neural pathways where the trauma was still sitting. Super interesting, if you don't mind sharing that. Talking to Granger Smith, and people are really texting in saying, just affirming you, Granger, and saying, so true. We can never know when something tragic like this could happen. Could happen to any of us. So true. Granger Smith is my guest today. New York Times bestselling author. Used to be a country music singer at a pretty high level, but he left the industry to go into seminary, go into ministry. Like a River is the title of his book. His son's name was River. Finding the faith and strength to move forward after loss and heartache. We'll be back in a minute. This is Susie Larson, host of Susie Larson Live. You know, I learned a valuable lesson while walking through one of the deep valleys of the shadow in my life. Our hearts can't live without hope, and we have reason for hope because Jesus is with us in every season of life. Using the word hope as an acronym, I want to remind you of four very important truths when it comes to hope. That God is a healer. One way or another, He will heal and redeem your story. O is you are meant to overcome. P is you have a purpose and a calling. And E, God wants you to live with eternity in mind. If you're struggling to make it to the next moment, text the word hope to get a fresh dose of hope. We are here to help you and walk with you through this journey. You can text 877-933-2484. Thanks so much for tuning into Susie Larson Live, talking to Granger Smith. He's a New York Times bestselling author. Before that, he was a country music singer. You could probably find his music online. But one fateful day in 2019, when he was out playing with his daughter, helping her with her gymnastics routine, he just had an instinct to look over his shoulder and found his three-year-old who'd gotten through the gated fence around the pool in their backyard. It was gated, and that little boy was lying face down and ended up dying. And this story, Like a River, Finding the Faith and Strength to Move Forward After Loss and Heartache, is so rich and so deep and so insightful. We've got a handful of copies to give away today. You can text the word book to 877-933-2484. And Granger, there was a point where you had to go back to work because you had a staff of people relying on you. As much as you can, talk about that.
For several reasons, I wanted to go back to work. I would say, one, I just needed a distraction. I needed to get out of that house. I needed to get out of that, the view of that swimming pool. I needed a change of pace. And then I think number two, I needed to take my family with me. I needed to give them an opportunity to go and see a Ferris wheel or a county fair, something we were playing during that summer. I also needed to pay the bills. I had 14 traveling musicians and crew on salary. I had their families to think about as well. There was only so long we can go without any kind of income to help supplement what they're doing as well. They're all on salary. So all of that equaled about 3 weeks after we lost Riv, it equaled going back and fulfilling some dates we had on contract.
Wow. And you said in the book that you had to really put on a facade. I mean, how else would you do it? Because you had to sing songs, you had to be there for other people, and you were hemorrhaging. I mean, how did you do that?
I did it one day at a time. And I think that's probably advice that a lot of people need to hear as well. Whenever you're at ground zero, because we, in this conversation you and I have had, Susie, we've kind of covered a lot of ground of the grief process for me and the grief journey. But when we're talking about ground zero for anybody, we're talking about even within the first year, you're making it one day at a time, because some days you slip and you go two steps back and you feel like you're you're never going to make it because you're just going backwards. It's important to recognize that grief is a wave. It comes in waves. And when we recognize this is a pattern, a wave, and it's crazy if you think about how many things are waves, you know, sound waves and visual waves, and we have the waves in the ocean, you know, physical waves, and grief, just like those, comes in waves. Sometimes you're in the trough and it feels like it's dark and the world is closing in and there is no hope. And then you start rising again and you feel a little bit better. Sometimes this process takes seconds or minutes. Sometimes it's weeks or months, but you eventually end up back on the crest and you go, hey, you know what? I haven't thought about the loss all day long. I feel normal again. I feel about like I did before I lost my loved one. But then you have to realize that in that moment on the crest, you have to realize I will go back down to the trough because I'm riding a wave. And as you start recognizing you're going back down, you kind of just brace yourselves. You put the plywood up on the windows and go, the storm's coming again. I better be ready. And waging that war on the hurricane is a daily battle when you're in ground zero.
You write this: God willing, one day I hope to be able to look back and see that my life was measured not by decisions that made me feel happy or comfortable, but by the ones that mattered. For instance, none of us goes to a funeral because it makes us feel happy. We go because it's important. It matters. Sometimes the choices that matter are very uncomfortable. You know, I'm thinking about that in relation, Granger, to parenting. How did you keep from fear-based parenting after that, or did you not? I mean, how did you work through that?
There was a level of vulnerability that we needed to maintain in front of the kids. And then there was a level of privacy that we needed to keep from the kids. For instance, we didn't let the kids see any of those social media comments we mentioned on the last break. We would cover their eyes from, you know, metaphorically, from seeing the news reports so that they weren't just bombarded with that stuff all the time. But on the flip side of that coin, we wanted to be vulnerable when the light was on and we were all together. We wanted to also show them, you know, mommy's having a tough day. She's missing Riv today. So she's just in her room and she's resting because she's been thinking about little Riv, and it's a tough day. Do you guys have tough days? Have you ever had a tough day? It's okay. You know, it's okay to have a tough day. And we're all here for each other. And sometimes we grieve at different levels. Sometimes I'm having a good day and mommy's having a bad day. And then maybe tomorrow mommy has a good day and I'm having a bad day. But you know, we're all in this together. And whatever we're feeling is okay at the time. So living that balance between we're covering their eyes when it's too much, and we're also being very vulnerable and keeping the lights on when they need to see it.
So good. So good. We just got about a minute and a half, maybe 2 minutes left. But you got to talk about Maverick. Can you say a word about him?
You know, Mav, whenever we talked about how there is purpose in pain, and I talked about the first time I saw that was when we decided to donate River's organs. Well, the ultimate manifestation right now, besides my own rebirth and my newly cultivated desire for God himself, is this little boy, Maverick, our child, our youngest boy, that now exists on this earth, breathing oxygen, because another child is not on this earth anymore. That is crazy. I cannot even begin to put all that together in my mind, besides the providence of God. Because when you say, would you like to have River back? Of course, I want to say, yes, I do. But I would also have to lose Maverick in order to say that, because those two worlds don't exist at the same time. Thankfully, I don't have to. Those two things don't have to ever go against each other, because it is just God's providence. It is just what it is. Little Maverick is here. He's not a replacement of River, but he is an example of the profound grace that God shows upon his people when we trust and surrender to him.
I just want to honor you and Amber for the way you stewarded your pain, because God gives us a free will to choose how we're going to respond. And you chose to lean in and to wrestle within the embrace. And that's not easy, but that's the only redemptive way to do it. It's the only way to survive. So Granger, I just honor you. I bless you. I want to congratulate you on a I know you didn't write the book to hit the list, but you did. You hit the list. And thank you. I'm glad to have met you. Thank you for sharing your story today.
Thank you, Susie. And by the way, a shout out to our mutual editor, Kyle, who's listening right now as well.
Oh, wow, he's listening. Kyle, we love you so much. Thank you. Wow, Granger, I hope you'll come back again. And when they ask you about movie rights, just do think of me because I said it first. Maybe I said it second, but I was a person who said it. Thank you, sir. Bless you. Come back
Thank
again.
You, God bless you. Thank you.
You too, sir. Granger Smith, my guest, the book, phenomenal, Like a River, based on all your texts, people saying, got the chills, I got the tears, so much wisdom here today. I agree. Thank you for tuning in. We love doing this journey with you. We'll meet you back here next time. Thanks for listening to Susie Larson Live. Podcasts like mine are available because of your support. If it's important to you to hear things that encourage your faith, click the link in the show notes and give now.